Welcome to the Start Me Up podcast, part of MSW Media and the Sexy Liberal Podcast Network. I'm your host, Kimberly Johnson in DC. Today, my returning guest is Simon Rosenberg. Love Simon. He accurately predicted the 2022 election, saying there was going to be no red wave, and there was not. And he's been accurate ever since in his predictions. We're going to have a great chat today, but before we get into it, the Start Me Up podcast is independent, listener-funded, and woman-run. Visit patreon.com/startmeup to see the variety of tiers offered, including the option to get a bonus What's Up episode every Tuesday. It's kind of like my online journal where I get a little more personal and I talk about whatever's on my mind. There's also an ad-free tier with a much shorter intro. Just visit patreon.com/startmeup. Now, please enjoy my conversation with Simon Rosenberg. Welcome back to the show, Simon.
It's great to be back, Kimberly.
It's always great to have you. And I'm so excited when you're on Lawrence, because Lawrence is my favorite. And I mean, I like the whole MSNBC lineup at night. And I have to say, Lawrence is my favorite. And it just makes me so happy whenever you're on his show. So what's it like? I mean, I know you're not usually in studio, but have you met him?
Yeah, I mean, we've met, believe it or not, only once in person. And he's a great guy.
Yeah.
And, you know, we all have known Lawrence, right? We all know him, right, from all of his years on TV.
Yeah.
And I've gotten to know him much better on air. I mean, I think we have a fun time on air. I think our conversations are, have the appropriate tone of, you got to be kidding me, that all this crazy stuff is happening sometimes, right?
Yeah.
And we laugh sometimes, which we all need to do,
because
given how crazy this all is. But no, I've really enjoyed being on air with him, and it's a highlight. And his team is amazing. They're just great to work with. It's just been a very pleasant experience all the way around.
Yeah, and I just had to say something because I love him. So, and I love you too. I think you're wonderful. You're so important to the conversation that we're having right now. So before we get into predictions and polls and what's going on with the Republican Party and et cetera, I'm just curious. I know you're not a psychic, but I'm wondering how you think this might go with SCOTUS today ruling on presidential immunity.
I tend to not follow these cases very much. And I think that, you know, one of the things I've talked about in my own writing is that we shouldn't have waited for Mueller. And what I mean by that is that we needed to talk to the American people about Russia's penetration in the Trump campaign and the Republican Party. And we had this faith in the legal system, the judicial process, the special counsel to go do this report and help explain to the American people. And by waiting, we deny the American people 2 years of a conversation about their own country, what's happening with one of the two political parties, about foreign entanglements. And it was a mistake. And we also, I think, in this election, shouldn't wait for Jack Smith or wait for any of the other prosecutors. You know, there are six things that we know today about Donald Trump that people didn't know about him in 2020 that I think we need to be communicating now and not wait for the courts. And those six things are that he raped E. Jean Carroll in a department store dressing room, that he oversaw one of the largest financial frauds in American history. He's been fined hundreds of millions of dollars, and he and his two sons are now banned from doing significant amounts of business in New York State. Third is that he oversaw one of the largest, he stole America's secrets. He lied to the FBI about it. Then share those secrets with other people in one of the greatest betrayals of the country by any former presidents. Fourth is that we know he tried to overturn an American election and American democracy. He led an armed attack against the Capitol of the United States, and he's promised to finish the job when he's in the office in the White House next year if he somehow gets there. Fifth, that he and his family have corruptly taken more money from foreign governments than any political family in history. And sixth, he's singularly responsible for ending Roe and stripping the rights and freedoms away of more than half the population. We don't need any permission from any judge to say all these things, right? Mm-hmm. And so we shouldn't, in our mind, I think, do anything other than have this incredible collective responsibility that we feel to educating our fellow citizens about who this Donald Trump is, how different he is than the Trump that came before, how much more extreme, how much more dangerous, how much more disgusting and degraded he is. And we got to get going with telling that story to the American people and not waiting for the judicial process to, because I think we've been persistently dissatisfied or disappointed. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to get my hopes up for anything to happen this year that may fundamentally change the election.
I feel exactly the same way. And I also feel like there are, I don't know who needs to hear a jury say that he's guilty. I mean, one jury already said he was guilty of rape. I mean, they didn't call it rape. It was, I can't remember what the official term was, but it doesn't really matter because he's guilty of rape and we all saw it. And then he said he went out right after that ruling and that decision and started defaming E. Jean Carroll, and that got him in even more trouble. So it's evident. I mean, aside from what he's on trial for, I mean, and they're big deal. Those are big deal cases, obviously, but we saw things happen with our own eyes. Like, who is the voter that needs that conviction in order to say, okay, then that's the case? I mean, I feel basically what I'm saying is I think we've seen enough, right? I think, I don't know.
Yeah, that's my point. My point is that what we can't do, because what's happening now, if you listen to the media, they're saying if he's convicted.
Right.
Or if the trial goes through, or the questions in the polling are, how will you respond if he's guilty? Mm-hmm. And the thing is, all the things that I listed, these are facts on the ground. They've happened. We don't need a court to determine them. It's like saying the sky is blue. Yeah. We know he stole America's secrets. We know he led an insurrection. It doesn't matter what the courts mm-hmm. find. And what we can't do is we can't let the contingency, this idea that these things may actually not be true, because there's a legal process going along the way. The legal process is only to determine his punishment. Mm-hmm. It's not, in my view, because we know that these things have already happened and that we need to remove ourselves. We have to leave the legal domain and enter the political domain. And the political domain, all of this stuff is fair game. Mm-hmm. And we should be as aggressive as humanly possible about educating our people about the most unfit and terrible person to ever run for president in our history.
Yes, 100%. Now, I want to ask you something that I've asked you before, and I want you to explain it so that when I go out and try to talk to people, I keep seeing everybody say ignore the polls, but then you come out and you show us some polls and you talk about these polls. So explain to people the inexpensive polls and the Republican polls, and that they're brought to MSN, and then everybody talks about it like this is exactly the way it is. So go ahead.
So we could spend the rest of the show talking about this because there's so much confusion, but let me try to do it quickly. I don't believe in ignoring the polls. I don't believe in that. I believe that data is data, and you have to look at it, mm-hmm. and you have to contend with it and wrestle with it. And what Tom Bonier and I did, and I came on your show during the 2022 cycle, right, is, we were able to explain that, look, there was a lot of data showing a red wave. There was also this other data, frankly, I felt more compelling data, showing it was going to be a close competitive election. And what would have been responsible for commentators was to have acknowledged that not all the data was pointing in the same direction. Mm-hmm. And that there was, that data was fighting. There was data fighting with data, right? There wasn't a consensus. There was actually sort of, and you had to wrestle your way through it. And Tom and I not only looked at polls, but we looked at things like fundraising and performance in the early vote and performance in special elections. And we expanded the aperture, right, in which we were looking at beyond just polling. And so when I do my commentary at Hopian Chronicles, or I'm here with you, when I come to my assessment about where things are, I'm looking at how much fundraising, how's the fundraising going, the quality of the arguments that we have, the quality of the campaigns and the media, right? Are you getting endorsed? Is the party behind you? All that kind of stuff that, I sat down recently with the head of the DCCC, Julie Merz, to go through the top House races. We didn't talk about polling at all. Because in all the races, the polling was close, mm-hmm. right? And so there wasn't really any reason. We talked about all of these other things, right? Performance on the stump, whether they're going to get whether they've been convicted of 88, or indicted for 88 felonies, right? And so I think the point is, one, is that there's a lot more information that we all have at our disposal to determine the health of a candidate or a political party. I mean, when you buy a house, you don't buy it just solely on price, right? It's location and how many bedrooms and how's the light and is there a basement, right? I mean, so when you assess the health of a campaign or a candidate, polling is only one piece of the data and the information that's available to us. It's an important piece, but it's only one piece. Mm-hmm. The second thing is that we often, I think many of the people in what I call the polling industrial complex, exaggerate the accuracy of polling. And that, you know, polling has a margin of error usually of 2, 3, 4 points, which mm-hmm. means that a 48-48 race could be a 51-48 race mm-hmm. or a 51-47 race. So we're often, you know, when you see a poll that is a 4% margin of error and Biden's ahead by 2 points, he's not really ahead. Mm-hmm. It's really the race is even, right? And so where we are today, in my view, is that the election has improved for us by 2 to 3 points over the last several months. Trump is no longer definitively ahead in the race. We have a little bit of momentum. And this is consistent with what I and many other people believe what was going to happen, which is that as the general election began and voters started paying attention, that Biden's numbers would go up because Trump is an historically awful candidate and Joe Biden's a good president. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what's happened. And I think another evidence of that is what's happened in the voting in the Republican primary states, where Trump has, you know, when people had to go vote, when they had went through that process of getting more educated, having to make up their mind, going from sort of being distant, it's far away, to like, holy crap, I got to vote, I got to make up my mind. Trump underperformed public polling and lost ground in all of those early states. And that's also what's happening, I think, in the general electorate right now. As people are now, as we're getting closer to voting, there's now two candidates, I got to think about what I'm going to do. Trump's eroding, right? We're improving. And so it's why I feel confident, you know, and I'm optimistic about, you know, what we're going to be able to do this year. I think finally, I think the issues that, you know, we're getting in a lot of data about fundraising in the first quarter, you know, our fundraising advantage because of the Democratic grassroots and the passion in the Democratic grassroots has become very material and substantial in this election. It's not getting nearly as much coverage as it should be because somehow the Republicans always manage to claim, well, you know, they're really not really winning. They're actually losing somehow, right? But the fundraising advantage that we have is a big deal, mm-hmm. and it's a huge problem for Republicans. This is another reason why I'm optimistic about what we're going to be able to do this year.
Okay, well, we have to take a quick break, but we'll be back after this message. Hey, this is Kimberly, the host of the podcast you're listening to right now. Are you a patron? If not, just go to patreon.com/startmeup. There's all kinds of tiers. You can choose which one works for you, and you can support the show today. Thank you so much. I keep hearing people, well, we keep hearing people, there's a few of them that are saying that perhaps Democrats might actually win Florida and Texas now because of abortion. I know there's a little, I think it's in Florida where legal marijuana is also yeah. On the menu. But how do you feel about those two states right now?
Yeah, listen, I think my theory since I began Hopium in March of last year was that because of their escalating extremism, more was possible for mm-hmm. us now, right? And we saw that play out in 2023. We had a very successful election. We won all across the country. We won this important bellwether in New York 3, the Swazi race, mm-hmm. you know, by 8 points. And I think that now we're already seeing in North Carolina, right, the polling there now is dead even. I think we have a real opportunity there. I think Arizona, because of Kerry Lake and the 1864 mm-hmm. law, is also going to create opportunities for us to make gains because of their escalating extremism. You know, I think in Florida and Texas, but particularly in Florida, because the 6-week ban is very unpopular in Florida and women are about to go lose, you know, there are going to be millions and millions of women in Florida about to lose their reproductive freedom, that more will be possible for us in 2024. Whether we can make those two states competitive, I don't know. I think we should be open to it. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, you can't score unless you shoot. So unless you're open to something being possible, you won't seize the opportunity. But I don't know yet. I'm very excited. I was just in Arizona last week. I was out and campaigned. I did some events for the party out there. And I'm very optimistic about what I felt there on the ground, the intensity, the enthusiasm, and the sense of outrage over the 1864 law. You know, what we also in North Carolina, you know, we've had these two polls taken in the last few weeks that show Josh Stein up by 8 and 9 points in his race for governor. You know, against an unbelievable extremist, Mark Robinson. And if Josh Stein wins that race in for governor by 8-9 points, Joe Biden's going to win North Carolina.
Wow.
And we happen to have, you know, this young superstar, Anderson Clayton, who's the party chair in North Carolina, who's building the most comprehensive and aggressive field operation we've ever had there. And so I'm very bullish right now on, you know, I think everyone thinks that we're favored in Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. I'm now very bullish on Arizona and North Carolina. I think Georgia's going to be hard. I think we don't have anyone else running at the top of the ticket. Trump now lives in a neighboring state. Mm-hmm. I think Nevada will always go down to Election Day and be close to Election Day. But, you know, if we win North Carolina and Arizona, we're going to, you know, Donald Trump's not going to be president. And so I'm very, you know, for all of you who've got a marginal dollar, a marginal call you can make, marginal postcards you can write, texting you can do, canvassing you can do, I would recommend people really focus on Arizona and North Carolina right now. Let's hope that Florida and Arizona become competitive
right
as we get, you know, because what's going to happen is the Republicans in Florida now have to go defend a 6-week abortion ban. That polls at like 22%. And it's going to be very hard. I don't think Republicans really understand what it's like to have to go litigate an issue that's in the low 20s on something that really matters to people.
Yeah.
Because no one's ever really done it before. I mean, there hasn't really been in the modern era of politics an issue like this that's so unpopular and so important to voters, right, as, you know, these draconian abortion bans.
Yeah.
And I will say one last thing about that, if I can just sort of finish the thought, is sure. that, you know, Trump, in his idiocy a few weeks ago, tried to do this thing where he's like, he thought he was so smart, right? You could tell when he was announcing it that I'm going to be leave it to the states, right? And
right.
look like a moderate and like whatever the states want to do, it's okay with me. But what he was doing in his idiocy and his diminishment is that he was embracing and endorsing the most extreme abortion bans
yes.
in the country, right? So if Idaho, which has no exceptions and has mandatory jail time for doctors, and has, you know, the trafficking statute where you can be, you know, jailed for trafficking a minor mm-hmm. out of the state. If he's okay with that anywhere, then he'll be okay with that everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And so what he did was that in addition to being singularly responsible for ending Roe and stripping the rights and freedoms away of more than half the population, he also outed himself in his idiocy as the most dangerous abortion extremist in America.
Yeah.
Backing things that poll at 15 to 20, putting the Republican Party now firmly on the side of these extreme abortion bans that poll at 15, 20, 25% all across the country. It's a huge problem. And it's a central reason why the Biden campaign is focusing on this so much.
And I mean, as far as you're concerned, do you think that abortion is the number one issue, or do you think it's a combination of, you know, climate and school and shootings, mass shootings and school shootings and the forgiving of the student loan. Yeah. Do you think it's like the combo of that?
So listen, economy, healthcare, always number one, number two, number three for voters, right? You can't take your eye off that. And frankly, our advantage on healthcare issues has actually gone up. They were substantial to begin with,
mm-hmm.
but they've gone up. And we can't, you know, even in the Harvard IOP poll of young people, of 18 to 29 year olds, Democrats, healthcare was the second issue, in the list. Reproductive freedom, by the way, being first.
Right.
Economy, jobs, healthcare, standard of living, living a good life, being healthy, those issues are always at the top. But, you know, for our coalition, issues around loss of democracy and freedom, reproductive rights, climate change, gun safety, you know, all these things matter, you know, hugely in the election, less so to Republicans, right? Many of these things. But for the people that are available to us, the 60% of the country that are not, you know, the 60, 65% of the country that's not MAGA, you know, we have a powerful agenda to take to them. And
yeah.
I think that one of the things for all of your listeners to remember is that Trump, you know, is not only more extreme and dangerous, not only is his performance on the stump far more degraded than it was, not only is this party a raging dumpster fire and having all sorts of internal problems, the opposition to him in the Republican Party, two former vice presidents, former party nominee, former national party chairman, many dozens and dozens of people who served in his administration, who've come out and said, Chris Christie just yesterday came out and said, I can't vote for Donald Trump. We've never seen anything like that. Mm-hmm. There's an unprecedented rebellion happening inside the Republican Party against Trump. And I think it's, you know, it is a potentially existential threat to his candidacy, mm-hmm. because he has to grow his vote from 2020 to win.
Yes.
And right now, it makes it, when I look at what's happening, where he's told Haley voters to get lost, you know, again, another moment of Trumpian idiocy,
yeah.
right? That he told a whole bunch of his own voters to get lost, right? this is really, I think it's going to be very, very difficult for him to win as we prosecute this campaign over time.
So what do you think the chances are that Democrats can take the Senate? I mean, the people believe we're going to take the House. So what about the Senate?
The Senate, I think, will go down to Election Day. I mean, I think it's 50-50 right now. I mean, the good news is that all the polling is positive for us. We don't have any incumbent senator in trouble. No one's behind, right? Tester and Sherrod Brown are ahead in the limited polling that we have. Jackie Rosen's ahead, you know, in Nevada, and Gallego looks strong, and I think people feel good about Alyssa Slotkin in Michigan, and I think some people are getting nervous about Maryland, but there's a general view that once we pick our nominee there, we should be able to win. The state is so overwhelmingly Democratic. We have a very strong governor there, you know, who can make a case for our nominee, and so I think in general, you know, this race. Today, you know, it looks 50-50, right? But, you know, could one of those races go sour on us? Mm-hmm. Of course they could. Do we have any way to make it up on the back end, you know, with Florida and Texas? Maybe, right? But, mm-hmm. you know, but it's still, I still think it's, you know, unlikely that Florida and Texas become possible for us. It doesn't mean it won't. Mm-hmm. You know, Ted Cruz is now involved in what could be a significant, you know, problem for him, the way that he sort of illegally funded his super PAC, right? And he did bad things. Like he did things that appear to be illegal in fooling around with his podcast and the super PAC. And I think, you know, little things like that in a race that could be a 2 or 3, 4 point race, you know, could make a huge difference, right?
Yes.
Because he's not popular in Texas. He is truly one of the great assholes of this era.
Yes.
And unlikable. Despicable people. And so these kinds of reminders that he's a sleazebag, right, is not helpful to a guy who actually is a sleazebag,
right,
and already has a problem with being kind of a scummy, you know, shitty guy.
You tweeted that one of the things that makes 2024 different than previous elections is the intensity of union support for Biden. And you said this stuff matters. So can you be specific on why that matters?
Yeah. So there's two things going on with unions that I think are important. Is that Biden has been the most pro-union president in our lifetime. I mean, there's been no president who's been so explicitly championing unions and creating an economic program that would benefit union workers, right, and the kind of work that they do, championing the work of workers that don't have 4-year undergraduate college educations, and valuing that work by creating unprecedented investment in that kind of work through infrastructure and CHIPS and the climate bill, you know, that we passed. And I think that he's also just shown tremendous respect, you know, first president to ever go on a picket line. Mm-hmm. You know, he's gone to these unions, met with them, talked to them, hired, you know, union folks into his administration, and they feel respected by him. And I think what they're doing now is that they're turning around and they're fighting for him, and they're spending a lot of money. And the media that they're creating in these early days is sophisticated media to speak to their own, you know, their own members to try to get them to come vote for Biden. And in states like Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, where you have very high density of union workers, you know, who tend to be, you know, white working class guys where we've had some issues in recent years, you know, even if we pick up just a few points with union workers in these states, that could be the difference between us winning and losing.
Yeah.
And so there's an unprecedented enthusiasm for the Democratic nominee in the labor movement. And I think it's really going to matter, in particular, in those three states.
One of the questions that I have for you, I don't know if you can answer this, but we keep seeing like the economy is doing really well and jobs reports and all of that. And then you go out into the world and I mean, I hear individuals talking about how bad the economy is and they clearly aren't following what's actually happening and perhaps they might be having a hard time of it. But in the general sense, the economy is booming or doing very well. So what do you have to say about that kind of messaging and, you know, how can we better inform the public about the economy?
Yeah, we have work to do here. I mean, I think the good news is that among Democrats, people give Biden very, very high marks on the economy, and they also believe the economy is doing well. Mm-hmm. It's Republicans who think anything that Biden does is terrible, right? So it's not possible that Joe Biden could be overseeing a strong economy. And this is an area where the right-wing noise machine has really had, mm-hmm. I think, a significant impact in convincing people on the margins that things are bad. When we have all this other data, when I talked earlier about sort of expanding the aperture and opening up, being open to other data, when you look at the economic data, people's attitudes towards the data, what you see is there's incredibly high life satisfaction, mm-hmm. job satisfaction, income satisfaction. There's also one of the areas I'm most interested in now, and I think is very, I feel optimistic about, is that, you know, in a recent poll of the battleground states, there was they tested, how do you think the economy is doing nationally? How do you think it's doing in your state? Mm-hmm. And in every one of these seven states, the people felt the economy in their state was doing really well. Well, it doesn't take a big leap to be able to say it's doing well because of Joe Biden, mm-hmm. particularly when you have Democratic governors and elected officials in those states, in places like Arizona, saying, hey, you know, we have a booming economy here. Let me tell you why it is. It's because of Joe Biden, right? That's not a hard thing to do in mm-hmm. politics. It would be much harder for us to get credit for the economy if people didn't think it was better. Mm-hmm. But where they think the national economy is not doing so well, but they think the economy in their state is doing really well. And that's, we can work with that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, we can take that and then say, because, you know, I was in Arizona last week. And this is a true story. I'm not making this up. Mm-hmm. I was in an Uber going from an event to another event. And we drove past one of the areas where there had been massive investment in chip plants, mm-hmm. you know, and you could see the construction happening. And the guy, the Uber driver, just volunteered that you see all this construction, you know, these are chip manufacturing plants. And he said, this is creating enormous, jobs. Because I told him, you know, it took me a long time to get an Uber. And he said, well, we don't have any Uber drivers because everyone's working.
Wow.
And there's so many jobs. And he said, I'm Uber driver now because I quit my job. I didn't like my job. And I've been interviewing and I'm starting a new job next week. And that job, and he said, you know, anyone who doesn't have a job in Arizona right now is because they're not trying.
Yeah.
Anyone who wants a job can have a job.
Wow.
And he said, I'm going to get a much better job. I'm going to be paying more money. I'm really happy with what I'm doing. He said, this is a boom town. And I said, well, can I tell you why that is? Right. And we then had a conversation. And he was open, you know, he didn't really know. He wasn't very political, right? But, you know, that was a real story. That really mm-hmm. happened, right? And that this guy was, like, driving by these huge things being built, and he had pride mm-hmm. in them, right? Mm-hmm. He was excited about what it meant because he was young, right? And so he knew this meant that these jobs were creating opportunity for him for his whole work life.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that we, once the campaign really kicks in and the ads go up and surrogates are campaigning and people have to start paying attention, we have a very strong case to make. And I go back to this basic thing about where I think the election is now, which is that Joe Biden is a good president. The country is clearly better off today. We have a strong case for re-election. The Democratic Party is strong. We're unified. We're raising tons of money. We're winning elections all across the country. Mm-hmm. And they have Trump. and what is Trump, right? Trump's the ugliest political thing that any of us have ever seen. And their party looks far more like a raging dumpster fire than a well-oiled machine. And so that's my view about where things are now.
Well, you beat me to it because I was going to say, what do we have to be hopeful about? And I wanted you to basically sum all of that up, and you just did. So I am totally with you. I had a friend call me the other day panicking, who does not follow politics, and said that, you know, she doesn't want to watch even MSNBC because she's sick and tired of feeling like she's afraid of everything. And so I gave her your name and I said, you just need to follow Simon. Now I'm going to, is it Tom Bonier? Is that how you say it?
Tom Bonier.
Bonier. Okay, Tom Bonier. Yeah. And I gave her both of your Twitter accounts. And there's a few people on Twitter, there's a few people out in social media, including you two, who are getting it right. And I think, you know, I mean, obviously MSNBC, which is my network, that's the one I watch. I don't watch all of it, but I trust the, like I said, the nighttime lineup more than anybody else. And I think, and you're on it often, so that's good. And I think that we all have to remember to just kind of stay calm, because what we're seeing out there is intentional chaos to throw everybody off. But there's all kinds of information. And if everybody just follows Simon and then goes to the Hopium Chronicles, which is on Substack, you know, you can be in the know and you can be armed with this knowledge. So it's not just about empty hope or, okay, this is what this person told me. Simon's giving you really good information about why we, you know, the reasons we have to be optimistic. So I just want to say thank you once again. I'm going to have you on before the election, but well, at least one more time. But I am so grateful for everything you do. And I'm grateful that I think I saw you prior to the 2022 election, and I became addicted to your tweets. So just thank you so much. And I'm, you know, tell everyone where to find you, but I think we already know, but just in case.
So I want to just end by saying that one of the main slogans we have at Hopium Chronicles is that we do more, worry less. Right? We all have to worry less. And when we have these worries that we all have about our democracy, about them, we just have to go to work and help, you know, Democrats win. That's the response, right? So my site and community is called hopiumchronicles.com. You can subscribe for free. It's free. If you want to become a paid member and get a little bit more, you can do that too. That money helps me keep the site free and open and available to folks, and pays the bills here in my house. And, but it's, and I'm on Twitter at SimonWDC, but where the real action is on at Hopium Chronicles. I mean, I write 6 days a week. We have live events and we have a great community. So come, the water's warm, come dive in, come hang out. And maybe you can hear my dog barking a little bit in the background, but he's a little crazy. He's old and barks too much. The journey I've been on in the last couple of years is I've been able to meet people like you who are proud patriots who love your country, who roll up your sleeves and go to work every day. And it's been unbelievably inspiring to me. And so thank you for what you do and for the hard work that you do every day. And, you know, let's go win this election. Let's go kick their ass together.
Yes, thank you. And let's totally kick their ass. All right, Simon, it was great talking to you, and I will talk to you next time.
Thanks, Kimberly.